and welcome to What on Earth, the podcast in the Environmental Investigation Agency, or EIA. This year, our organisation is marking 40 years at the forefront of investigating and campaigning against environmental crime and abuse. From the early days as pioneers of working undercover, we've come a long way in four decades, and as part of our celebrations, this podcast will be talking with some of the longest-serving campaigners in EIA about the work they've done and the changes they've seen. I'm Paul Newman, EIA's Senior Press and Communications Officer, and today I'm pleased to be joined by Mary Rice, the Executive Director of EIA UK. Mary, welcome, and thanks for taking the time to share your thoughts with us.
You're very welcome.
To start with, can you give us a bit of your background, what you were doing before you found your way to EIA?
So before I stumbled across EIA, I was trained originally as a journalist, and then I spent the next sort of 15 years in education, and that involved teaching training and training trainers, predominantly in Japan and Hong Kong, but also in Cambridge. And I decided I wanted a career change. And so I came back to the UK, and I had a place at to do a master's in environmental science. But I had 6 months to sort of waste, if you like, or to do something useful with. And a friend of mine pointed me in the direction of EIA because they were looking for volunteers. And that's how I came to walk through the door of EIA. And that was in February 1996.
And what were your first impressions of the organization at that time? What was it like?
Well, it was smaller. It was in very plush offices because they'd got this really great deal with the landlord. So, you know, they had very nice office space and across four floors. It was relatively small team of people. And at the time, the number of campaigns was quite limited. You know, there were elephants, tigers was just beginning. The forest work was just beginning. Obviously, whaling and small cetaceans was ongoing. But at the time, it was one of these things that it was all hands on deck for a lot of the sort of things. So if there was a conference coming up, everybody was involved. Uh-huh. And I was essentially brought in to act as an assistant to the then chairman, Alan Thornton, who's one of the founding directors. If I'm honest, it was all a bit chaotic. But, you know, it was the energy in the place was amazing. You know, there were a lot of really, really sort of driven and passionate people and young people. And some of them are still with us, which is testimony to, I think, the organization and, you know, their own passion.
And when you mentioned it, obviously, when you joined as Alan's assistant as a volunteer, how long did that period last for until you were kind of taken on?
So I was probably offered a paid post after about 3 months. And then I went through a sort of period of being promoted to then head of development. And I was responsible for some of the fundraising with the statutory and trusts and supporting the executive. We had a supporter services, you know, unit who was self-contained. And at the time, EIA had a lot more unrestricted income coming through the door through membership initiatives and merchandising. So we've changed quite considerably over the years. And now most of our funding is from a restricted source through statutory or private trusts and foundations, and a smaller amount through unrestricted income. So yeah, it's a very different organization now.
Yeah. You mentioned obviously a lot of what you're doing was in the operational side of EIA, but you're probably best known outside the organisation for your work fronting our elephants campaign. How did you come to transfer across to that?
So I was the first time I was sent out into the field for EIA was I can't remember it would have been 1996, so it was towards the end of that year, and I was sent to Mozambique essentially on a fact finding and filming mission. We had this big event coming up, and they wanted a film to sort of showcase the work that we'd been doing at the Elephant Rehabilitation Reserve in Maputo in Mozambique. So that was the first time I went out in the field for EIA. Shortly after that, though, and then I was sent to lots of different conferences. I started understanding what was going on in the elephant world. My first experience of the polarized debate and argument around the elephant issue was at the 1997 CITES meeting in Harare. Those meetings can be really quite toxic and hostile. So it wasn't a pleasant experience. And it was at that point that the international ban was slightly diminished because the parties agreed to allow three countries to downlist their elephants in order to sell their stockpiles. Shortly after that, I got the opportunity to go and do some research and photography in Namibia. So I essentially left full-time employment with EIA and went to spend time in a very remote part of Namibia to do the photography and research for a book, which was then published subsequently. But also during that time, I did little bits and pieces as a consultant for EIA. And a lot of that involved looking at elephant-related issues and illegal trade and poaching. And that's really where my involvement in the elephant issue formally began. Then after 3 years, I came back to the organization, and that was in 2001. And then since then, I've held a number of different positions in the organization. So when I came back after Namibia, I was made head of comms and special projects. I wasn't formally working on the elephant campaign at that time. We had an elephant campaigner and we had some investigators working on it, but I became increasingly more involved in some of the on-site field visits and sort of outreach and engagement with governments. So yeah, from about 2002 onwards, I became more formally involved in that arena. But I was also involved in some of the cetacean work, you know, attending the IWC, for example. I did a little bit of work with the forest team as well. I was head of comms, and then I was briefly head of campaigns. And then I was, then we changed, the organization changed, and I became the executive director, but also leading the elephant campaign because we didn't have the staff at the time or the resources to sustain a full campaign. So that was an interesting period. For a while, the elephant campaign was hibernated, which is unthinkable actually at the moment when you think back now to our successes.
Hibernated because of a lack of available funding, obviously not because the issues were any less pressing.
No, just because of the lack of funding. But you know, thanks to, you know, other staff and the campaigns director, we managed to keep the campaign alive, and we managed to secure little pots of funding to help us to do some activities, and often piggybacking on the back of other work. I think a lot of the work was piggybacked on the back of a significant amount of work we did around the construction of fences across Botswana. A very dry topic, but basically, the Ministry of Agriculture wanted to create this massive cattle fence across the Okavango, which would have stopped the migration of some key iconic species and some key migrations. And we were asked to be involved and to assist what is now the Ministry of Environment in Botswana through access to the EU. So we used the Joint Parliamentary Assembly of the EU, African, Caribbean and Pacific nations to prevent the construction of the fence, which we did. And it was interesting because on the elephant issue, EIA and Botswana are not great friends, but on the fences issue, we were the best of friends. So it was an interesting exercise in how you can work to your strengths, agree to disagree on some things, and work together on the things where you have common sort of aims and desires.
And I guess that's all about establishing relationships with government entities and other bodies so that you can do better work down the line together.
Yeah. So, yeah, a lot of it is about building relationships of trust, frankly. And I think that is a fundamental building block of the work of EIA is, you know, campaigners and, you know, members within our operations team as well, and the comms team and the fundraising team. They build relationships of trust that enable us to sort of be open and honest, and to assist. Sometimes we have to be the sort of the front, because you're dealing with countries, for example, that stop civil society from having a voice. So yeah,
that's quite difficult spaces to work in, I guess.
Yeah. So if you're working in a country where civil society is challenged, because the government doesn't want them to speak their truth, then EIA can be the proxy. We can be the bad cop.
So yeah, I've often heard that used in my time at EIA, that, you know, there's good cop, bad cop, and we're usually the bad cop because we're deemed to be in a position where we can speak truth to power, I guess, to some extent, because we're not actually leveraged within the countries in which we work. Often we don't have expensive grant projects and offices out there, so they've got nothing to really hold over us to tell us to shut up.
Yeah, I think it's a deliberate decision not to have in situ programs, because there are, you know, we have come across examples where some very well in NGOs, international NGOs, have been gagged, you know, in country, because if they actually released information that they had available, and for example, Tanzania was a case in point. You know, we knew that there was huge amount of poaching going on between 2009 and 2014. And these organizations also knew what was going on, but they weren't able to release that information into the public domain. Because if they had, they would have lost all of their research licenses and they could have been kicked out of the country.
And so then they're back to square one somewhere.
Yeah. So that's where EIA plays a very key role. I think it's an interesting position to be in, sometimes very uncomfortable.
Because we're often out there as the only voice, I guess.
Yeah, and sometimes you meet real hostility. You know, I've been threatened by, you know, senior government officials, and shouted at and screamed at. So, yeah, that's a difficult position to be in.
Well, that brings us on to the next question, really. Given that you've been wearing so many hats in your time with EIA, what have been the most vivid memories of working for EIA? And it doesn't have to be a time when someone was shouting at you.
No. Well, I think being threatened with a highly venomous snake does stick.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But I think there are lots and lots of different memories. You know, some of them are around very obvious successes. So, you know, since that initial relaxation of the ban on international trade in ivory back in 1989, we have managed to hold the line so that it doesn't get weaker. In fact, it's now stronger because we've managed to get countries like China to close their domestic ivory markets. We've got the UK to close its domestic ivory markets. But we've had a sustained sort of campaign that where we've had to, at every single conference of the parties, produce the evidence and the information to make sure that people are fully informed about what is actually going on in the ground. Because often these countries will completely fabricate anything about their regulation, their control, their number of animals being illegally killed, in order to be given permission to sell stock. But we're in a very good place at the moment because international ivory ban is still very much in place, and there are actually really no buyers now who would be interested in buying any stock that now sits in the sort of strong rooms of Botswana Namibia and Zimbabwe and South Africa.
Yeah, this might be a good point to mention something which is, I suppose, a common misapprehension about the nature of ivory trade is that, and I'm sure you've encountered this yourself many times, the argument that why are you opposing stockpile sales? You know, the ivory is already off the elephants it came from are already dead. If you use it to flood the market, you'll reduce the demand and therefore actual live elephants won't get poached for their tusks. Obviously, we don't believe that as an organization because our line is that basically trade kills, is it not? The selling the stockpiles wouldn't do anything except send a signal and wave a green flag for more poaching and more sales.
Well, there is evidence to support that. And also the argument is that if you sell the ivory, you can use the money, the revenue from that sale, that to put it back into conservation. But in the two sales that have occurred between 1999 and 2008, I think, I'm just losing track of the years, but there's no evidence that that money was put back into conservation. And those countries are not compelled to tell everyone what they spent the money on. So we know that it doesn't always go back into conservation, if at all. We also know that by selling the ivory legally, you are effectively stimulating demand. If someone sees ivory legally available, then people think, oh, this is okay. When China and Japan were given permission to buy during the second one-off sale, what happened was that, yes, they bought 50 tons of ivory and they were allegedly going to flood the market, but they didn't flood the market. What they did was they created a limited release into the market. They escalated the prices to the traders, and we're talking about China now. So the registered traders found themselves having to pay anywhere between $600 and $800 a kilo for this ivory that the Chinese bought for $150. And the black market saw this as an opportunity to undercut the government prices. And this is when the poaching in Tanzania started. It had started slowly in the sort of early 2000s, but by the time it got to 2009, you were losing multiple elephants every day in one particular area of Tanzania, the Selous Game Reserve. And in the space of 5 years, the Selous Game Reserve lost over 60% of its elephants. All of that ivory went to China. And we documented that in the report that we produced called Vanishing Point.
See, the successes in terms of closing ivory markets have been quite notable. What other major successes have you noticed on your watch the IAA has played a major part in?
So I think we played a major part in helping. There's a small organization in Zambia that we first encountered back in 2001. And they were really, just a bunch of local people who pulled together to try and tackle what was then a snaring issue in South Luangwa National Park. So they'd kind of set themselves up. They call themselves RATS, R-A-T-Z, Rapid Action Team Zambia. But obviously, they were filling a huge gap and they were being funded predominantly by the tour operators in the area. So we spent some time with them in 2001 and 2002. They were in fact instrumental in helping us to expose, this whole syndicate that had been operating out of Zambia and to Asia, which resulted in the Singapore seizure back in 2002. They were instrumental because they had documented what was going on. And so what we were able to do is help to get them seed funding to set themselves up properly. And then we went back in 2005 and we produced a film for them because by that time they'd managed to build a base for all of their, they'd become much more professional. They were now being trained. They had uniforms. They had created access to water for the village. They hired women rangers. And so we had a big sort of celebration. We produced a film for them, and we set it up in this base camp. And I remember at the time we had to get multiple extension leads plugged into each other to go from a house across, I don't know how far, how many meters, so that we could actually screen this film. And the amazing thing about it was all these young kids who'd never seen what their uncles or their dads or their mums do and the kind of work that they do, they were able to see, you know, the amazing work they did. So that sort of thing I count as a huge success.
Yeah, because I suppose it's not just informing people about the value of what they're doing, it's informing the people around them, the community more widely as well.
And it's a thriving organisation now. So, you know, we are still in touch. So there's lots of, you know, those relationships that, you know, you build up over time. And I think that is one of EIA's real successes, is engaging, you know, communities and local conservationists and helping them to actually protect the things that we want to protect as well, but to be able to step away at the end of the day and say, right, it's in safe hands. We don't parachute in and parachute out, but once we've got things established, we step away. We're always there if they need us, but that's been a real success, I think.
It's one of the things that's often said about us, is that we're boots on the ground. And although a lot of people might interpret that in terms of we're there undercover and we're scoping for information, the reality is we're often building bridges with other NGOs, with government departments, with communities, as a better way to further our work.
Yeah, and I think there's a kind of investigation is central to our is to our name, but investigation covers a whole range of things, and obviously we've become much, much more professional as an organisation. We're bigger. We've now got dedicated people who are there, you know, they have the skill set. If you think back to when I first joined, we didn't have internet, or, you know, we hardly had email. So everything, all investigations are founded on having a really accurate situational analysis and understanding what's going on the ground to inform what you need to do to uncover, to expose. So a lot of the investigative work is actually going out there and reaching out and talking to people and finding out what's going on and documenting that, producing that into a kind of analysis. And then the actual investigation, subsequent investigations that might take place, are all informed by that information. A lot of that now we can do online. We don't have to do the big field visits that we used to do, which, you know, is a shame for younger staff, because I feel like they've missed out, because that was one of the best things about being able to, do the work, because it was often very uncomfortable and you weren't staying in nice places and it was a lot of rough traveling and perhaps upset stomachs and awful food, but you got to see things that you wouldn't have done otherwise and to meet people. And I think that's the other thing that's, for me, the best thing about EIA is the people that I've been able to meet. I've met the most amazing people, from well-known people to people on the ground who are just doing their job, who are absolutely inspirational.
You've been with us for on and off, allowing for the odd sabbatical here and there for the best part of 30 years. What changes have you seen yourself in the nature of environmental crime in that time, and how has the organisation adapted to meet them?
I think probably the sort of increasing involvement of organised crime. I think, you know, with the sort of advent of the internet and social media, and easier communications. And I mean, the world has shrunk. It's easier to move around. It's easier to travel. Although increasingly now we're going back the other way. So, you know, with bureaucracy and Big Brother and, you know, closed circuit television and China and all of its sort of, you know, controlling sort of strong arm.
This is the fingerprint scans and facial scans as soon as you arrive in the country. So you're just in a database somewhere.
Oh, they've got glasses as well where you can, it's quite extraordinary. But I think increasingly it is very organized. And it's an enterprise, it's a criminal enterprise. And often the criminal organizations involved in ivory are involved in pangolin trade, in timber trade, in gemstone trade. They might be involved in firearm trade. You know, it's a commodity. And, you know, the markets, the demand for these products tends to be in Asia. And so the criminal networks tend to be Asian networks. But they do operate as well with the support of people in the countries in which they work. They do need that kind of support. So, for example, when we were doing the work around Vanishing Point, you know, it was a culmination of almost a decade of investigations. But essentially, what we were able to sort of expose was, yes, it was run by Asian organized network, but they had, you know, they had people in their employ or their buy. You know, they were corrupt customs officers, there were taxi drivers, there were people moving the goods around, and those were all Tanzanians.
There's a whole network around the actual organized crime gang.
Yeah, and I think crime gangs anywhere will exploit where there is weak governance and, you know, corruption. So, you know, they're very adaptable. So when they think that they have compromised themselves or they feel like they've run out of goods to access, they'll just move somewhere else. So
overall, do you think the secret of AI's success over the years, is there a secret to our success over the years, or is it down to just sheer tenacity and staying the hall?
I think it's a combination of both. I think it's a combination of that tenacity and being in it for the long game, because any systemic change takes years. So that's really important. It's also about adapting. I think EIA has adapted. It probably needs to adapt more as it's grown, because, you know, we are now triple what we were when I started. So all of that has an impact on the way that you work. But we also do a lot more policy work than we used to. And we have a lot more kind of varied skill sets within the organization. So we've got ex-enforcement personnel. We've got ex-filmmakers, we've got lawyers, we've got scientists, and we've got biologists and journalists. And I think one of the things about EIA, which is very unusual, is that we have four generations working under one roof.
Yeah, as you say, we tend to hang on to quite a lot of people, and a lot of people that leave often circle back to us in the end anyway.
And if they don't circle back, they often go off and set up successful outfits themselves. So, you know, it's a good training ground for people. And I think, you know, there can be a criticism that people stay for too long and they become institutionalized. But the other side to that is, well, people stay because they're passionate or because they have institutional knowledge. And because they're valuable.
Indeed. Well, in your own case, I mean, you've been working on and for elephants now for an enormously long time relative to how long people might spend at an NGO typically, as a result of which, certainly from chatting to you, you've got that knowledge where you know everybody involved. You know the players, you know the politics, you know the issues. And it's like you can't just walk into an organization and come up with information from scratch. So there's definitely an advantage to having people like yourself who've got that history with the organization and the issue as well.
Yeah, I think it's really important as well. And I think that's what probably is a selling point that we don't make the most of, because we do have a very long history in many of the issues that we still work on. if you look at, you know, we were the first, one of the first organizations to work in the context of the Montreal Protocol back in, you know, the sort of the 90s when we first started that work. I mean, that work was born out of our cetacean work. I mean, it seems like that's very weird, but that is how it started. It started on the back of a piece of research that looked at environmental threats to cetaceans. And it became obvious that the ozone was a threat because it was harming the cetacean population. So that's when we started looking at ODS, ozone depleting substances. And that climate, what is now the climate campaign, was born. And we've gone from strength to strength. I think it's important that we remain relevant. So, you know, the argument is that we still do the stuff that we used to do, but the problem isn't over yet. So we have had to grow in order to take on new challenges. But we also recognize that there are other organizations working on issues that, you know, if they're already there working on them, then we shouldn't need to.
Yeah, yeah. And you mentioned challenges. For a final question, what challenges do you see ahead for the organization as we move into our fifth decade?
So I think the challenges, obviously the biggest challenge is always funding, how we sustain ourselves as we grow. And, you know, as we grow, the challenges change because we have to become more professional. And also, you know, as the world has changed, there's much stricter regulation around what charities can do. There's much stricter regulation around employment and all of the things that you, as an organization, you have to sort of adhere to, all of which comes at quite a lot of cost. So that's a challenge. The other challenge is that there are an increasing number of other organizations coming into the space who do very similar work. And, you know, I think for us, the challenge is how we maintain our place in that little microcosm, because we do have, it's actually more than 40 years because the founders were working on these issues before they actually set up EIA.
That's right.
So although, you know, it is formally 40 years, it is longer. And, you know, we pioneered the use of film in exposing environmental crime, and we pioneered the use of undercover investigation. And there are others now doing the same. But we've also grown and gone down different avenues. So we do have, you know, we have real policy experts. We have changed laws. You know, the investigation is a small part of the toolbox required to influence and, you know, encourage change. It's that information that provides the decision makers with the evidence they need to say, yes, we need to change the law. And if you look at what's happened with the forest team and the amazing work they've done over decades, it doesn't happen overnight.
Indeed. Well, Mary, thank you very much for joining us today and sharing your thoughts. And here's to having you back on the show in 10 years' time as we celebrate our 50th.
Sure about that.
Now, if you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, please watch this space for future episodes and check out our website at eia-international.org to find out more about our work. Thank you for joining us, and wherever you are, stay safe out there.